Innovation Minds presents At the Edge, a podcast about using innovation to empower and drive engagement. The nature of work has changed. Companies around the world are struggling to find the right balance in the new work-from-home hybrid paradigm. As much of the workforce begins to go back to the office after more than a year working remotely, how can leaders keep their employees engaged and collaborating successfully? In this podcast, we interview thought leaders from business and hear their stories and viewpoints on how to use innovation to engage the workforce, as well as how to innovate engagement.
In terms of identity, I think one of the biggest things I've been thinking about recently is what little rituals we can do that let people know they're a part of our team. Right. So we always had these little rituals. Every organization has rituals. Some are really elaborate, like pick your sales organization. There's usually some gong type ritual, right, where you close the big deal and you get to run to the front of the room and smash a gong, or sometimes it's a bell, or, you know, something weird like that. And every organization has them, whether they're acronyms or little jargon or things like that. But a lot of them were based on in-person interactions instead of thinking about what virtual rituals would be.
David Burgess is the best-selling author of four books about business and leadership, including most recently, Leading from Anywhere, a primer on hybrid and remote work. He's worked with leaders from organizations across all industries, including Google, Fidelity, Viacom, and even the U.S. Naval Academy. A former business school professor, Burgess has a master's degree in organizational psychology from the University of Oklahoma and a doctorate in strategic leadership from Regent University.
So, David, welcome. It's really an honor to have you here. I've read a lot of your work and really, really pleased to get to hear from you today.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Thank you so much for having me.
Your book, Leading from Anywhere, has recently come out, and it is one of, if not the most important books on remote work that's around. It starts by telling us that remote work is actually not something new.
Quite simply, it's not all that new. Depending on what your definition is, sometimes it's, you could think of it as hundreds of years old, right? I mean, the original corporation was the East India Trading Company, and that by definition had to be remote work, right? And then even in the context that most of us think, meaning knowledge work economy and not having to work from an office all the time, is not all that new. Even in the 1970s and 80s, as soon as the communication technology to allow it to happen developed, we started seeing a movement, an upward trend. I mean, it was a very poor slope, right? But it was a rising trend. It wasn't exactly flat or even going negative. It was always two steps forward, one step back in this sort of remote work revolution. And the biggest barrier to all of that was just basically this idea that, how do we know people are working, et cetera. We had managers blocking that case, right? Saying, I can't tell if they're working, if they're not here, et cetera. And then the great work from home experiment happened, right? Where we collectively, the entire knowledge work economy said, okay, we're going to try and work away from each other for as long as possible. And it worked. I mean, it took some readjustments. It took a whole lot of burnout. But fundamentally, I mean, the thing that I'm hearing now is a lot of people find out I'm much more productive. I've been way more productive. And whether or not that's a sustainable productivity is something we explore in the book, and what that does to culture, and how you have to be very, very different about building a deliberate culture in a remote environment, that, you know, that obviously changes as well. But for those reasons and more, I think it's not necessarily going away. Here in the United States where I am, my prediction on remote work is that post-pandemic, the percentage of the American workforce that works fully remote will double. And when I say double, I mean it'll go from 4% to 8%. But more importantly, the other 90-something percent of people are going to be headed into a much more flexible working arrangement where not everyone on their team is at the office all of the time. So we might as well continue to cultivate those skills of collaborating from afar, because we're going to be collaborating from afar for the rest of our careers.
Can you share some of the information, statistics, and so on about why remote work actually seems to work better?
Right now, I'm working with a lot of leaders that are talking about return to the office plans and those sort of things. And everybody thinks in hours. And I think that's as in how many hours or how many days do we want people back? And that's the wrong approach, because that's also not what makes remote work work. The question is, what types of work are we talking about, right? So right away, there are fundamentally in a knowledge work setting, there are two different types of work, right? There's collaborative work, and then there's sort of solo focused work, or what Cal Newport would call deep work, right? There are times where you need to have meetings, where you need to create a problem solve, you need to come up with solutions. There's times where you need to collaborate on documents and that sort of thing. And then there's times where you need to be left alone and be given time to focus. And the offices that we all left, even before there was the threat that they would make us sick from COVID, they were making us sick from a whole lot more. I mean, the research was really clear on it. People, especially if you were in one of those open offices, offices were interruption factories. Offices were places where you ended up getting called into about as many terrible meetings as you got called into terrible Zoom meetings, plus the idea that people could tap on your shoulder if you had a cubicle or something like that at any given time. We know that people were more likely to be actually physically sick, more likely to be stressed, absenteeism rates were higher, et cetera. When it comes to that deep work, that solo focused work, the office is a terrible place to get it done. Now, that said, I think there a lot of collaborative work, a lot of creativity and problem solving, that's still better, going to be better done in person. But that doesn't mean we have to be there from 8 to 5, 5 days a week anymore.
Let's talk a little bit about the use of technology to achieve that. What you used to achieve in the office, you have to now achieve in a distributed way. What are the ways that technology can help?
A couple different ways. I think what's funny to me is that the number one technology that everybody's talked about over the last 20 months or so has been video chat technology, right? Love it or hate it, right? And I, to be totally clear, I think a lot of the endless Zoom meetings and the Zoom fatigue we were all facing was actually because team leaders were not used to this idea that presence didn't exactly correlate to productivity, right? They had raised and managed in a situation where I can see you, I know what time you're coming, I know how late you're staying, so that's how I know you're working. And that's a huge problem when you suddenly do a forced work from home experiment. You get a lot of managers that cling to this idea that like, oh no, I can't see you, therefore I need to find reasons to see all of us together. And so we ended up getting invited to far more meetings than we needed to take. A lot of that doesn't necessarily need to happen. The research on most effective way to collaborate, we'll get into tools in a second, and most effective way to collaborate as a team argues for what the researchers called bursty communication, meaning small periods of time where we come together and hash out issues and hash out details and then go separately away from that. And so the tools and technologies that I think are actually much more incredible in this remote work setting are asynchronous tools, are collaboration sharing documents. I mean, the lo-fi versions like Google Docs, but even high-level versions like a variety of different whiteboarding softwares and project management softwares that let people collaborate. Yes, they could collaborate in real time, but perhaps more importantly, they can sign into that whenever they're ready and see the running thread of communication, not worry about being left off of an email and that sort of stuff. So that's the technology that excites me far more than any improvements made in Zoom over the last 20 months. Those technologies, I think, because that's the key to making remote work, is to trust your people to do a lot more uninterrupted, asynchronous work rather than, oh, you need to always be on Zoom because I don't know you're working if I can't see you, or at least the pixelated version of you.
Now, hybrid work, we talk about hybrid working, you know, part-time or half-time in the office and the rest remote. You say in the book that it seems to be the best model. Why is that? And how can companies manage that differently than just pure remote work?
Yeah, so I'm gonna hedge my bets here too and say let's it depends on what we mean by best, because certainly I believe that hybrid is actually harder. I think it'd be the easiest thing you could do coming out of the pandemic is go right back to where we were in January of 2020, right? And just say everybody back, right? I don't think you'll be able to do that. I think if you try that, you're going to get all sorts of people quitting and finding more flexible offices. And so what most people have settled on is this hybrid. But hybrid is actually harder because it requires you still using the skills of remote work, and it requires you fighting that proximity bias. But once you do fight that proximity bias, a lot of huge benefits come. I mean, the first and the one that everybody is sort of sensing and talking about right now is from a pure talent standpoint, when the world is your talent pool instead of a 60-minute radius outside of Cleveland, Ohio, then suddenly you have the opportunity to build teams and to tap into much more innovation, much more creativity, because you've got much smarter people that are suddenly viable candidates. I think you've also got inside larger organizations, you've got this idea that now that everybody's had 2 years of learning how to collaborate virtually, we don't need to look to the people to the left and to the right of us to build teams inside the organization. So even how we form teams around certain projects is much more geographically dispersed. So you have that as well. And then I think the biggest thing is we know this from 40 years of research, that if you give people more trust and autonomy over where they do their work, how they do their work, et cetera, they end up being more productive and more engaged. And hybrid allows for that. It allows for people to say, well, you know, I finished anything I need to be doing at said office and it's 3:30 and I have no reason to just sit around and wait till 5 because it's culturally acceptable that that's when we leave, right? I can actually go do something that actually restores me. I could beat the line to the gym, or I could go pick my kid up from school instead of waiting for the bus and having them let themselves in to the house. And then maybe I'll circle back when you know, at 7 or 8 o'clock at night, when they're done, when they're put to bed, and I'll focus in on a little more hours of work. Like, giving people that freedom of their schedule keeps them more engaged in the organization and makes them more productive because they know when and how and where they're at their best. And now we're giving them the freedom to do that.
It's interesting because hybrid can mean two things, right? Like you've pointed out, it could mean somebody who works part-time in the office and part-time at home. And it can mean a company where people are working in the office and others are, you know, across the world. What's the difference between those two models?
So that's actually a great point. And perhaps maybe we should use hybrid to discuss the latter, hybrid to discuss a mix of people who are in the office and collaborating remotely. I've sort of been using, because most of my work focuses on teams, I've sort of been calling those virtual teams, as in we don't care where you are. Some are in the office, some are not. So we're collaborating in a virtual space. And hybrid, the better term for it is probably flexible, a flexible work arrangement, which by the way, is what most employees want, right? When you're in the midst of doing all these surveys right now, as we are, about when are we going back to work? What do you want to do, et cetera? Even most of the employees that say, I want to work remotely 2 days a week, they don't actually want to work remotely. What they want is flexibility and autonomy, right? And that means that they'll be working remotely some of the time, but deep down what they actually want is flexibility and autonomy. Once we get used to this idea that we're going to be in different, we're going to have the world as a talent recruiting pool, or we're going to have people from multiple different offices coming together on a project, regardless of where they are, we can build teams that are much less on proximity. It's shocking to me. This is actually a really consistent research finding that at least prior to the pandemic, one of the most consistent predictors of who you ended up collaborating with at work. We saw this in a knowledge work setting. We saw this in the academic setting. We saw this in a laboratory setting, in a variety of different studies. The number one predictor of who you're going to collaborate with on projects is proximity. In other words, you're 6 feet away from me, or you're on the same floor as me, or you're in the same building as me. All of those concentric circles make it more likely we're going to collaborate. Well, we've just had 2 years of maybe breaking away from that. And as long as we can keep that mindset that I want who in the organization would be the best people on this project, we can see a much bigger advantage than looking around to the left, to the right, and picking the 4 or 5 people that are around us, which is what we normally do.
You say the basis of good remote or hybrid work, it seems like you're centering around the idea of sharing. You listed understanding, identity, and purpose, and finding ways to share those three things.
Shared in this sense, meaning that it's common, that we have a common knowledge on this, we have a common agreement about it. Do we actually have a common understanding about each other's knowledge, skills, abilities, their work preferences, the context we're working in? And is that actually accurate? Does what my team thinks of me actually match what I think of me in terms of strengths and weaknesses, work preferences, et cetera? That's shared understanding. Identity, and this is the big thing I worry about in those some people are here in person and some people are here remotely settings, is a sense of shared identity. Silos are nothing new to organizations, but prior to now, they've almost always been based on function. You know, marketing will always hate legal, don't care what organization it is, right? You can just count on that happening. Now we have the potential to have little in-group biases and silos and preferences towards the people who I see every day and the people who I don't. And that can be a problem, right? And shared identity, this idea that we're working to make sure people see themselves as one team, they're working to see themselves as one collaborative group, that's huge. And the last piece around shared purpose is really my way of describing what we do to connect people back to why we do this work. In particular, purpose around who and around I use the term in the book, who we're fighting for or what we're fighting for, not as in fighting against competitors, but what is this larger mission and how well can I connect it back to the work I'm doing every day. And this is crucial for an entirely different reason than getting teams to collaborate. It's crucial for keeping top talent. It's crucial for surviving the quote unquote great resignation and keeping people engaged. It's so much easier when you're working from home for a company where you're so used to working and collaborating in the office. It's so easy at the end of the day to not make that connection between who you're helping inside the organization or how that organization is helping its industry or society, et cetera. It's easy to just see it as a random list of tasks that popped up in your email inbox and you do them all and then you go back to Netflix or whatever. And it makes you wonder, okay, why am I doing this, right? If it's not for that shared purpose piece, then I'm not engaged.
Now that you've taken us through that, give us the secret recipe. What do we do in a hybrid situation to overcome the challenges of hybrid in building shared understanding, identity, and purpose.
So in building shared understanding, I mean, my biggest recommendations here are always seem so simple, and yet people don't necessarily do them, right? So I think, you know, the easiest one is, how well are we sharing calendars? How well are we aware of when each other are actually, I was almost going to say working there, but I don't like to say working anymore. I like to say responsive versus non-responsive, right? Do we have someone sitting there at the end of the day, it's 3:45, and they're sitting there waiting for a response on an email that's not going to come because that person's done for the day because they started work at 7 a.m. because that worked better for their schedule. Or the opposite happens, right? We have that one person who's the night owl and they're sending 11:30 at night emails and then jumping on the meeting the next morning at 9 a.m. going, did everyone see the email? No, not everyone on your team saw the email, right? Because some of them are starting their day with this meeting. And so they haven't had a chance to see it yet. So that's like a an easy surface level sense of shared understanding. But I think it's also, you know, understanding the context people are working in, the what they're going through, what life stages they're in, because all of that's going to affect how responsive they are, how collaborative they are. In terms of identity, I think one of the biggest things I've been thinking about recently is what little rituals we can do that let people know they're a part of our team. Right. So we always had these little rituals. Every organization has rituals. Some are really elaborate, like pick your sales organization. There's usually some gong type ritual, right, where you close the big deal and you get to run to the front of the room and smash a gong, or sometimes it's a bell, or, you know, something weird like that. But in the sales organization, that's a big deal, right? And every organization has them, whether they're acronyms or little jargon or things like that. But a lot of them were based on in-person interactions instead of thinking about what virtual rituals would be, right? So like one group I worked with, the virtual ritual we came up with that helped the team feel a sense of identity with each other is they went on Fiverr and they hired some graphic designer to design like 6 Zoom backgrounds, virtual backgrounds that had the company's core values on it. And the idea was, hey, we have a Monday morning all hands meeting and our ritual is, before that meeting, think about which of these core values you want to focus on developing in this meeting. Do you want to be more bold? Do you want to be more inclusive? Do you want to be, I don't know how you would work on integrity other than not lying, but like it was the different core values. And so you signed on and you saw what every member of your team was working on or focused on. You knew what that meant because you did the same ritual yourself. And so you felt a little more in-group than when you're on cross-functional teams and everybody's just using that blurry background or pretending they're at the beach or what have you. On the shared purpose, my best concise piece of advice here would be, how well can you connect the work that we're doing to who benefits from that work? I think it's really easy to forget that project that we're working on, that deliverable that we're focused on, that goes to someone else in the organization or to a customer of the organization, and it helps them in some way. And often, especially in a remote environment and especially in a large organization, people forget that. And so how well can you, anytime somebody expresses gratitude, if you're a team leader and a peer, another manager or your boss expresses gratitude, make sure you share that with the team. How well can you connect when you're asking somebody to do something? When you're doing your check-in with individual people, can you remind them how important their work is for other members of the team to be able to do their work, right? It's funny. There's this book. It's pretty popular. Came out a long time ago. Maybe a decade ago. And it talked about the importance of talking about purpose as a why. And I actually think that's wrong. The more I look at the research on it, purpose is a who. People feel a sense of purpose and task significance when they know who benefits from the work that they're doing. So how well can you as a leader draw that obvious who to them and keep reminding your people of it?
One of the things I noted when you talk about shared purpose is that, you know, you're saying that the best shared purpose is not about the companies succeeding or, you know, getting through a difficult time. You actually listed 3 specific types of purpose. Can you get into that a bit?
This little trick that I do when working with teams is that if I'm trying to get a sense of how well they've internalized organizational mission or vision, I'll ask the question, what are we fighting for? Now I actually ask the question, who are we fighting for? But that's a different story about why I've changed. And I categorize them into 4 answers. I get 4 different types of answers, right? The first answer I get is, I don't know, or they'll recite the existing mission statement, right? And it's just as good as saying, I don't know, right? Because when you've got this buzzword laden 4-sentence long mission statement, you haven't internalized it, right? I'm impressed that you can remember it, right? But you haven't internalized it. And then the other 3 I get fall into 3 different categories. And I call them sort of the 3 fights. And so that's the revolutionary fight, which is how our group or how our organization is working to change something about the industry, something about the society, something about the organization. Sometimes when you can point to the status quo is this, and here's how we're working to change it, you're leading a little miniature revolution, right? And that has its own motivating effect. Then there's the underdog fight, which is about being on the receiving end of unjust criticism. You know, so-and-so, either the organization says our department's the smallest one and we're going to prove them wrong, or they say that there isn't a big enough market for this specific service. And then the ally fight is actually sort of a arm's length, right? Because it says it's not actually about us and what we're fighting for. Our customer or our stakeholder or society is fighting for this. And we help them do that. And here's how we do it. You could actually reframe the mission in any of those three ways. And that's where managers and team leaders come into play, because different people resonate with different elements. I was born in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, which is like the city of underdogs, right? Our greatest sports hero is a fictional character who loses a boxing match, right? So I resonate much more with the underdog story than your average person. So can you restate, can you talk about what the organization is doing? And can you restate that as something that resonates to each individual differently? When in doubt, go with the ally fight. And that's why I've changed it to who are we fighting for? If you can connect it to who inside that organization you're helping, how did you make Sarah's life easier today, right? How did you help so-and-so come off with a much better solution to a problem that they were working with, right? When you can connect it to that who, the work that you do matters because it makes the work that other people do easier or better, et cetera, you can still tap into that ally fight piece, even if there's not this larger mission. So that's why I find myself bringing it back to who much more often these days.
What would you say is the biggest determinant of success in a remote team?
I would say it's managing the balance between freedom and accountability, right? So, and this is something a lot of managers struggled with right off the bat. Managing the balance between freedom and accountability, meaning that we're going to default to trust and we're going to default to letting the team come up with what works best for them. Some people choose to be in the office all of the time, some none, some people a mix, et cetera. But whatever you pick, like the line I use a lot of times when I'm talking with organizations about how do we, what does our remote or return to work policy look like? I say, well, the question you should be answering isn't that. It's how do we create an office where everyone feels welcome, but no one feels obligated, right? At the same time, there are a lot of situations where you give people enough rope and they will hang themselves, right? You give people enough freedom and you'll never see them again. And that's a problem, right? And that's where some people default to being out of such a fear of that, they default to end up being a micromanager, constantly checking in on people. Well, a team always does a better job holding individuals accountable than an individual manager does anyway, right? So that's what I really look for in making this work is how well does the team know that they want to give each other maximum freedom to determine when and how and where they do the work, et cetera. But also they have systems in place that keep each other accountable, not relying on just the individual manager to always be the bad guy or the bad girl, but the team itself is holding each other accountable.
When you're getting into holding each other accountable, obviously it involves communication.
I really, really like sometimes called the scrum or the daily stand-up from the world of agile development. For a long time, you had software development teams that would meet in person for a quick stand-up meeting every day, and they would answer three questions. What did I just work on? What am I working on next? And what's blocking my progress? And I find, truthfully, that most teams don't have easy answers for each other on just those three questions, right? Just think about it. And so this doesn't have to be a stand-up. It doesn't have to be daily. I see a lot of success with teams that I've been working with over the last year that do this as a weekly Monday email. So every Monday, they email out to the rest of the team the answer to those three questions. Here's what I completed last week. Here's what I'm focused on this week. And then here's what's blocking my progress, which is a great way to ask for help without admitting you're failing at something. So you let the team actually start helping each other, kind of like they used to do when they were all in the office together and they could talk to each other much easier, right? We do a great job at calling them together at Zoom meetings and then talking at them instead of letting them connect around three simple answers to three simple questions that can make a huge difference. What did I just finish? What am I focused on next so no one's going to drop the ball? And then what's blocking my progress so that we can find ways to help each other?
You talk about probably the most important element of culture being psychological safety, and the two elements of safety being trust and respect. And it seems like when you look at safety, trust, and respect, those are three things that are hard to achieve hybrid, especially if people like never meant it, people that never actually met each other before, right? People that actually met online and working together.
It's harder to express dissent. I mean, that's the biggest thing. And then it's your people who, it's how you respond to people who disagree that affects the trust and respect piece, right? But it's just harder to speak. It's hard to speak up on a Zoom call, right? It's hard to be the one box that's disagreeing with everyone else who, you know, first of all, if you talk over anyone else, then suddenly the mics of everyone cut out, nobody hears you, right? But it's just, so logistically, technology-wise, it's hard, but it's also just mentally hard. You're seeing all of these people in agreement. And in the room, a skilled facilitator, a decent manager might see that little micro expression of dissatisfaction on your face, notice it, and draw you out. They're not going to notice it in this pixelated form of you, right? So it's harder even for the facilitator to notice it. It's really hard to be the one person disagreeing when the reply alls and an email start flying, right? To be the one person that disrupts, well, actually, maybe this, right? Try and create more space for people to express dissent. When you're on that Zoom call, don't just spend the last 2 minutes. Okay, any questions, right? Actually admit whenever you, and this is just good advice in a virtual or real life environment. Whenever you feel like there's a consensus happening, that's a really strong signal that you need to stop and go, okay, we're probably missing something because we got to consensus really quickly. What are we missing? And then when people disagree with you, how you respond to that goes a long way. People notice that, and it determines whether or not they trust you to have a psychologically safe response to their dissent. And they notice the language you use and how well that either contributes or doesn't contribute to a culture of civility and respect. So that'd be where I would start, right? It's a whole lot harder to have teams go through task-focused conflict in a remote environment. And so we need to make space for it to happen more often so we can model the way of how it's supposed to happen when it does.
You talk about some research in the book as well around trust and respect, that an environment that has that has significantly lower stress, more energy, higher engagement, more productivity, and so on. Where do these statistics come from, and how do you actually get those levels of trust and respect?
There's a couple different researchers in here that I want to give credence to because they're doing some great work. The first one around psychological safety and where this trust and respect comes from is Amy Edmondson, who coined the term, who found the research on psychological safety, and was the one that talked about how it's based on trust and respect. And she's actually big on this idea that this dissent is a sort of starting place. In the book, I also talk about the research of Christine Porath, another brilliant researcher on civility in the workplace. Most people, when they report that their workplace is toxic or is uncivil, et cetera, and then you ask why, they'll say, well, it's because most people follow how the leaders act. As in, there's two or three people in a senior leadership role that are just nasty, right? Or have never actually had someone call them out on how their behavior when someone disagrees with them is belittling, or how they push a false consensus because they just want people to agree with them, et cetera. So how do you get it? I mean, it's one of those things that, as much as I love bottom up change, as much as I love bottom up culture and egalitarian change in organizations, some things do have to happen top down, and trust and respect is one of them.
Maybe the only thing that's harder in the hybrid space than communicating and collaborating is engaging.
Yeah. I mean, the interesting thing for me is that, the research on prior to the pandemic, or what I like to call BC research, right, before Corona research, remote workers, unquestionably most of the research where they were more productive, right? And this little footnote underneath all of that research that nobody really paid too much attention to was why they were more productive. The most common reason was that they worked more hours, right? They would start their workday when most people would start their commute. They would keep working until most people worked the commute. They would have a harder time blurring the lines between work and life. So they were much more responsive throughout the rest of the time. So no surprise that they were more productive. And no one thought about, like, okay, well, what if we had a global 18-month long work from home experiment? What would that increase in productivity do to their mental health? And I think we all figured that out like last summer, right, or last fall. That I'm more productive because I'm working more hours and I'm blurring the lines between work and life. It didn't work all that well, right? So we had this, like, honestly, this over-engagement, if we want to call it that. People were more focused on their job. But that did horrors for our mental health. It's the big challenge here is long-term sustainable engagement is actually about making sure that people don't believe their work is their entire life. Because as we all found out when we made our work most of our life for a while over the last 18 months, it's a terrible way to live, right? Working from home is fine. Living at work is really not a good way to live.
Let's talk a bit about hybrid creativity and the challenges and benefits there.
Wow. Okay. This is an interesting one. So, I mean, the first thing I would say is it depends on the work that we're doing, but I'm going to assume you're sort of like, let's take Dunder Mifflin from The Office, right? And let's design a better space. So it's like generic work. I mean, the first thing I would say is it would be an office space where everyone feels welcome, but no one feels obligated. And what welcome means is that there is a place for you. And in fact, there's probably multiple places for you. So you're going to need an office space that, even though you don't have people there all the time, could fit everyone there, but in a variety of different settings, right? So you may have certain people, certain functions that need an actual office with a door that closes. I doubt you would need that as much because people have the opportunity to hide elsewhere by leaving. But you would need different size meetings. You would need little sort of corrals for one-on-one meetings, 2 or 3 person conference rooms, 4 or 5 person, instead of like the traditional office was a sea of cubicles and then 3 conference rooms that fit 8 people. And it always felt weird to have a 2-person meeting in a 12-person conference table, right? So you'd need that the term I would use is palette of places. And then you would need some synchronicity on when would work best if we're here. And that's so different for every team that it's hard to do. Some teams that may be like, yeah, everyone's going to be here Monday. I think for most teams, the answer is actually times of day. If you are not a geographically dispersed company, you're all in kind of the same area. You were all working out of the office before the pandemic, and now you just know you want flexibility. Then thinking about, okay, what are the hours of the day that are sort of our meetings hours? Like, okay, from 10 to 2, it's cool to schedule a meeting and you won't step on anyone's toes. And that way we know most people are in the office from 10 to 2. But if you want to leave at 2:15, that's fine. If you want to come in at 7 in the morning, that's fine, right? We don't actually care as long as you're around that. So that would probably be what it looked like for me. But the other thing I'll tell you is that none of this matters at a company-wide level. And that's why I'm struggling to answer your question so much. It matters at a team level. Right? It doesn't matter what the company-wide program is. What matters is that we have managers that have some level of flexibility to come up with what arrangement works best for their team, and also feel free to change it 3 months, 6 months, 9 months later when the team changes or when the work that they're doing changes.
And what about the virtual part of that hybrid space? So in other words, you open your computer, you enter an online office. What would that look like?
If you're a team that even 20 months into this that still isn't using some kind of project management software, that manages asynchronous communication, then I think you need to add that to your collaboration tools, right? Because that usually defaults to asynchronous communication, which is what we're not doing all that well over the past 20 months.
If you had to give one last message to people listening, say that this is what David Berkus has to say about remote work, and especially like the use of technology to make remote work more human, what would you say?
I would say that connection matters more than connectivity. And what I mean by that is like the speed of your bandwidth and the tool that you're using to get everyone in a fancy Zoom meeting or some other chat stuff, that matters less than whether or not people are actually connecting human to human, whether or not they actually see their teammates as a real team, whether or not they know what else is going on in that person's life. I mean, this is one of the big downsides of a virtual collaboration environment is in an in-person office, I get to see your pictures of your kids and the degrees from where you went to school. And I get to learn much more about you that when we run these really efficient connectivity oriented meetings where speed of connection matters and let's fly through this agenda and boom, and man, that was a really efficient meeting. What gets sacrificed is the individual connections that team members build in the unstructured moments, right? So making sure you're allowing for that human connection matters so much more. And there are tools that help that, and there are tools that hinder that. But it also matters that you have managers who work to take advantage of that much more than what tool you choose.
Thank you, David. It's been really great to hear from you about all this. Really appreciate you being with us.
Yeah. Oh, thank you again so much for having me.
This has been At the Edge, a podcast from Innovation Minds. We look forward to hosting you on our next episode, which you can find through the same channel you got here with today. Please join our LinkedIn group where you can discuss every episode. You can find the link in the show notes. We're really glad you were here, and thank you very much from Innovation Minds.